Today is Monday, October 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, what impact will Islamic State leader al-Baghdadi's death have on the region and the world?
It deals a massive blow to the Islamic State, and it comes at a particular time when the United States was seemingly pulling out of that area.
Also ahead, a judge rules that the Democrat-led impeachment inquiry is lawful. What effect will that have on the president's defense strategy? Those stories and more are all coming up next on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump announced on Sunday that a U.S.-led military operation in Syria had killed Islamic State group leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
He was the founder and leader of ISIS, the most ruthless and violent terror organization anywhere in the world. The United States has been searching for Baghdadi for many years. Capturing or killing Baghdadi has been the top national security priority of my administration.
He said no U.S. personnel were lost in the mission. The announcement comes as Trump has been on the receiving end of bipartisan criticism in Washington following the recent pullback of U.S. troops from northeastern Syria. To take a deeper look into the significance this may have on the global fight on the Islamic State militant group, I spoke with Craig Albert, Graduate Director of Intelligence and Security Studies, as well as a political science professor at Augusta University. Craig, where I want to begin is this. I want to get your take on the significance of the raid that resulted in the death of Islamic State group leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
It's very significant. It deals a massive blow to the Islamic State, and it comes at a particular time when the United States was seemingly pulling out of that area. So this kind of reifies the United States' position over there in Syria and Kurdistan region. So I think it's a remarkable move by the United States to be able to get Baghdadi. It's significant also for counterterrorism operations, obviously, in two ways. One, we killed the leader, but two, as the Islamic Caliphate is losing ground, this becomes even more detrimental to them that now they're without their main leader. On top of it, they also lost their spokesperson over the weekend. There are some reports saying that. So this is a massive blow to ISIS over the weekend.
So let's dive into that a little bit more. I mean, this is an organization that has relied upon, at times, different publications, the use of the Internet to get their message out to would-be followers and many groups, whether it be in the Philippines or in Southeast Asia or Africa, have pledged loyalty to the Islamic State group. What kind of impact on those farther outreaching groups would this death have?
You're actually going to see some retaliatory attacks based on the Islamic Caliphate cyber affiliates. So they're going to increase their recruitment efforts. They're going to increase their information warfare on social media sites. They're going to do everything they can to leverage this, their death. They'll call it a martyrdom of their leader. And they'll actually try to increase attacks in these places. You look for something in Syria, but also look for it. Some types of attacks, probably some lone wolf attacks attributed to the death of Baghdadi in some of these regions like Afghanistan, perhaps even Chechnya and the Caucasus, where there are some small isolated affiliated groups of ISIS. They will look for a call to attack Western nation states as well. So this is typical anytime a terrorist group loses one of their leaders or a member of their leading councils, they call for retaliatory strikes. And usually you see an increase in interest in those organizations as well as an increase in recruitment efforts and recruitment itself once somebody with this high of a role dies.
What about within the region itself? Because, I mean, this is coming on the heels, as you mentioned, the U.S. withdrawal from Syria. So what kind of impact would an upswing in activity by the Islamic State group have?
Well, geopolitically, this is the most interesting part of the United States striking and getting Baghdadi right now is that it comes at this time when we were pulling out from Syria, where the Russians became pretty much the main actors in the region because of that. So this kind of shows that even though the United States pulled out of the region or significantly pulled out most of the sources, that it's still capable of deep strikes using special operations forces.
One last question. long term now with al-Baghdadi dead and the effects that the U.S. missions with the Kurds have had on the Islamic State group, what do you see taking place in the region in terms of stability long term?
I think it's going to be status quo as is now for a long time into the future. ISIS has been beaten back a lot. They've lost most of their territory, but they're still there, and they're still there in significant numbers. Not only that, but al-Qaeda is still there in great numbers as well. So we have several terrorist groups still operating in that area. So it's still very tense. Geopolitically, it's still very unstable. You still have Iran with ambitions there. You still have Russia with ambitions there. You see a more aggressive Turkey than we've seen in decades there, and you still have Assad there as well, who is trying to keep his regime and to regain some type of power and stability in his society.
Craig Albert is a political science professor and the graduate director of intelligence and security studies at Augusta University. Thank you very much for sharing your insight today.
Thanks for having me.
A senior U.S. diplomat on Saturday offered what Democrats characterize as corroborating testimony in the impeachment inquiry against President Donald Trump, although the witness was expected to tell lawmakers his knowledge of the events at hand was limited. Philip Reker, the acting assistant secretary of state for European and Eurasian Affairs, spent about 8 hours with the House of Representatives Foreign Affairs, Intelligence, and Oversight Committees behind closed doors at the U.S. Capitol. The testimony was the first piece of since the federal judge on Friday rejected a claim by the Trump and his Republican allies the Democrats' impeachment inquiry process was illegitimate because the full House has not yet voted to authorize it. Joining us now on the phone is David Barrett, a political science professor at Villanova University. David, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
I wanted to begin with the weekend testimony with Philip Reker. I mean, this was behind closed doors, but with what's been reported, how did that go for both the Republicans and the Democrats with this inquiry?
Well, I think there's a pattern now of people who have worked in the foreign policy apparatus of the administration, especially testimony, I mean, from State Department people, current and past. This is not good. I think this sort of testimony, and again, we're getting bits and pieces of it. I'm always a bit leery about relying on bits and pieces, although there are a lot of big chunks. Maybe it's more than bits and pieces. But I think this moves us to a situation that when eventually the House itself moves toward open hearings and then a vote by the House, it just seems to me inevitable that the House is going to impeach the president. The information first made available by the whistleblower, whose identity remains unknown, it seems to me just continues to be verified in a number of ways.
Charles Kupperman is a former deputy to former National Security Advisor John Bolton, was supposed to testify today. He responded to a subpoena. He did not go. This is after, you know, the judge on Friday ruled that this is a legitimate impeachment inquiry. And I wanted to get your take on what this means for the White House, because that has been their primary defense, as well as Republican allies, is that without a House vote, things can't go forward. But now the judge says, no, it's legit.
Obviously, this is a both political and legal victory for the House, House Democrats, House Majority, in moving this process along. About Kupperman, there's something unique there, which is that this is someone part of the National Security Council staff, part of the executive office of the president. So it strikes me that Mr. Kupperman is not unreasonable to be holding out for more specific ruling from a federal judge as to the legality or illegality of him testifying. So I read carefully this morning what he is asking for, and I understand he is being sort of threatened in a sense by both sides about whether or not it's legal for him to testify. I think that so the federal judge has ruled this inquiry is legal. I don't think that speaks sufficiently in a detailed way for whether or not Kupperman will or indeed should testify.
We have about 30 or 40 seconds left. I want to get your take on this from a political science standpoint.
Right.
As the impeachment inquiry and then possibly an impeachment drags on into primary and possibly even into greater debates as we move closer to the election, does that hurt one party more than the other?
Politically, I think it is in the interest of the Democrats to move things along in the year 2019. I just think that it is not good for the Democrats. I'm not saying it's great for the Republicans either, because more and more, again, when we get closer to an impeachment trial in the Senate, the trial, this is going to be excruciating for certain swing state senators as well. But I don't think it's great for the Democrats to just sort of carry this on too long without something official, which is an impeachment vote by the House. I think it would be ideal if they did it this year, but I didn't predict that. I'm just saying what would be ideal politically.
David Barrett is a political science professor at Villanova University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say Earth experienced a sudden change in climate nearly 13,000 years ago. Called the Younger Dryas Climate Event, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says the temperature of Earth's northern hemisphere suddenly plunged to near glacial conditions just as our planet's climate was warming from an ice age environment. One of the most controversial theories on what caused the climate event, subsequent decline in human populations, and the extinction of more than 35 large animal species, was the result of a huge asteroid or comet exploding into large chunks that hit the Earth. Researchers led by University of South Carolina archaeologist Christopher Moore have found evidence supporting the theory. Researchers found unusually high concentrations of platinum, an element that's related to objects like asteroids or comets, at three dig sites in South Carolina. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Hong Kong's financial secretary said the city has fallen into recession, hit by 5 months of anti-government protests that erupted in flames this past weekend and is unlikely to achieve any growth this year. Black-clad and masked demonstrators set fire to shops and hurled petrol bombs at police on Sunday, following a now familiar pattern with police responding with tear gas, water cannons, and rubber bullets. TV footage showed protesters who streamed into Kowloon hotels and shopping arteries of Nathan Road on Sunday, setting fire to street barricades and squirting fuel from plastic bottles onto the fires at subway entrances amid running battles with police. On Monday, a Hong Kong reporter disrupted a police news conference to protest what she called escalating violence by officers against journalists covering the city's pro-democracy protests. Tensions are rising further between police and media after violent demonstrations Sunday in which police used aggressive tactics against media and detained a photojournalist overnight. Roger Baker is the senior vice president for strategic analysis at Stratfor, a risk analyst company. Roger, I wanted to ask you this. We are now entering 5 months into these ongoing protests in Hong Kong that originally started off fairly peaceful. But where do things go from here, since this has gone on for many more months than many thought it was initially going to do, and very much stark contrast to a half decade ago with the Umbrella Movement in 2014?
Well, I think a couple of things have to be brought up. There's a real distinct difference between the structure of these protests and those of the Umbrella Movement. The Umbrella Movement was based off of the Occupy Movement and effectively required people to camp out for long periods of time. And it was tremendously disruptive to all levels of society, but also to the protesters in the sense that it was a nonstop action. This is protests more along the lines like we've seen in other Asian countries in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, even into the 1990s, where these are periodic, where they come out on the weekends or in the evenings, where they're not going to be running all the time, but where students or the protesters are able to come in and out. And therefore, it doesn't necessarily mean that these protests ultimately have to stop.
They don't ultimately have to stop, but Is there a tipping point for Beijing or even Hong Kong now that, Hong Kong is actually in a recession now?
Well, the economic impact is certainly being felt finally, and it should have been expected and anticipated. It is an economic impact, though, that is in part as strong as it is because of other underlying issues. For example, the U.S.-China trade competition, and that has had a huge impact. Overall slowdown in Chinese economic activity, which has had a pretty big impact on Hong Kong as well. So this set of protests right now has been a bit of a tipping point beyond for those economic activities. I think that when we talk about does this end or how does it end or is there a tipping point for the government or for the protesters, the Chinese government in some ways has been able to utilize what's going on in Hong Kong as a way to emphasize that democracy is not always the best and most stable way to operate, nor is it necessarily something that's good for economies. And so the Chinese government has gained a little bit out of this in regards to talking about Hong Kong in their own country and in, quite frankly, sympathetic countries around the world.
One of the things that the protesters are continuing to chant these days is five demands, not one less. Can they ever realistically achieve their other four demands?
There is room for four of the five demands. Carrie Lam, there's been, you know, the rumors up and down about her offering to resign in the past, about her potentially stepping down in the future. It wouldn't be surprising if she does not serve out her first term. On the government appointing a more independent investigation into the police, they've already started saying that if the current investigation, which is supposed to finish around December or January, is not accepted by the people, then maybe they'll go for that. Giving freeing the protesters from detention and potentially expunging their records, I think those are within the realm of reality, even if not probable. But that fifth demand, the universal suffrage demand, which is effectively a self-determination demand, that is the one place where I think Beijing simply cannot and will not give in.
Roger Baker is a Senior Vice President for Strategic Analysis at Stratfor. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Negotiations on a sweeping 16-nation free trade deal and a code of conduct for the hotly contested South China Sea are expected to take center stage at a summit of ASEAN leaders in Bangkok next month. The leaders of all 10 member states of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations are due to attend the bloc's regular end-of-year summit starting on November 2nd. Meetings related to the summit begin Thursday. China says it has asked British authorities to provide more information on the identity of 39 people who were found dead in a truck in southeastern England last week. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Gong Shuang said Monday that the United Kingdom has not confirmed the victims' nationalities. British police initially believed they were Chinese, but later acknowledged that the details were still evolving. Conservative President Mauricio Macri conceded defeat in Argentina's election Sunday evening, paving the way for the country's Peronist center-left to return to power under Alberto Fernandez, as frustrated voters rejected the incumbent's handling of a bruising economic crisis that has sunk many into poverty. The result would mark a dramatic return to high office of former President Cristina Fernandez, Alberto Fernandez's vice presidential running mate, former boss, and what critics say might be the power behind his throne. European shares retreated Monday as a glum profit outlook took the region's largest lender, HSBC, offset gains in the trade-sensitive sectors buoyed by positive developments on U.S.-China trade front. Luxury stocks stood out after Louis Vuitton owner LVMH made a bid to buy U.S. jeweler Tiffany & Company with a $14.5 billion acquisition offer. The European Union agreed on Monday to delay Brexit.
The draft decision to extend Article 50 contains three possible dates, one of which is even 1st of December.
The EU Commission spokeswoman Mina Andreeva made the announcement, calling it and the flextension. Joining us now from London is reporter Henry Ridgewell. Henry, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Steve.
So can you help us understand what a flextension is?
Yes, a flextension has a flexible endpoint. So while the European Union did grant this extension because they don't want to force a no-deal, a cliff-edge Brexit, they are just keen to get on with it. And if there's any sign that Britain will pass this deal that was negotiated between them and Boris Johnson 2 weeks ago, then they will happily cut short that extension period, and Britain could leave either on the 1st of December, as the spokeswoman you heard there said, or on the 1st of January, or this deadline extends to the 31st of January.
What's been the reaction to this news from Boris Johnson so far?
Well, this moment, I think the Conservative Party, his Conservative Party, were dreading because he had repeatedly said that he would leave the European Union on the 31st of October, do or die. And the moment has come where he has been forced effectively to accept this extension to Brexit until the 31st of January. So no matter what spin the government puts on it, that pledge has been broken, and you'll see the opposition parties now try to play on that, try to make their political gains from that broken pledge as we approach what seems like an inevitable election now at some point in December.
You speak about the inevitability of an election. Could while that is a distinct possibility, what is the opposition concerned about if there is an election happening before the end of the year?
Well, there's various dynamics here. The offer that Boris Johnson has made, and he is desperate to have an election because he thinks that's the only way he's going to get the Brexit deal done. He says he'll have an election on the 12th of December if MPs allow time to debate the Brexit deal before then. He wants to get Brexit done and then go to the polls and be the party leader, be the prime minister who says to the electorate, look, I've got Brexit done. We're now out of this mess. I've got all these exciting ideas. Elect me again and let's just get on with it. The opposition parties want to go to the polls before Brexit is done because they, for two reasons really, they want to prevent Brexit, particularly the Liberal Democrats and the Scottish National Party, and they see the only possible way of doing that now is a general election, but also they think that if Brexit isn't done by the time people go to the polls, they'll be so frustrated with Boris Johnson and the Conservatives, they'll see that he's broken his pledge, and so the Conservatives might not do so well. So there's that dynamic playing out as we speak in the Houses of Parliament. This evening, at some point, they're going to vote on Boris Johnson's suggestion of a 12th of December election. That's likely to be voted down, I think. Tomorrow, he said he will come up with this idea that the opposition parties have also suggested, which is a 9th of December election, with no effort to get that Brexit deal done before then. So that would be put on the back burner, and we would have a 9th of December election.
Henry Ridgewell is in London. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Iraqi authorities have imposed a curfew from midnight to 6 a.m. in Baghdad as renewed anti-government protests rage for a fourth day. At least 72 protesters have been killed since demonstrations in Baghdad and across the Shiite south resumed Friday after a brief hiatus. At least 149 people have been killed in earlier waves of protests. Protesters blame the government for widespread corruption, unemployment, and poor public services. And finally, U.S. President Donald Trump said Monday he is expected to sign a significant part of a trade deal with China.
We are looking probably to be ahead of schedule to sign a very big portion of the China deal. And we'll call it phase one, but it's a very big portion. That would take care of the farmers. It would take care of some of the other things. It'll also take care of a lot of the banking needs.
Leaders of the world's two biggest economies are working to agree on the text of this phase one trade agreement announced by Mr. Trump on October 11th. Trump said he hopes to sign the deal with China's President Xi Jinping next month at a summit in Chile. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer John Dryden, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for joining us. You'll also be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.